There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's an ad I didn't think I'd be recording. Today's Shut Up, Evan is sponsored by Clone a Willy, the at-home penis molding kit. Yes, you heard that right. The original Clone a Willy lets you create a homemade dildo out of 100% platinum cure metal grade silicone. Whether you want to replicate your penis or the penis of someone you love, or even the penis of someone you hate, Clone a Willy is a fun, body safe penis making kit available in 9 colors. That's right, 9, including light skin, dark skin, and even neon purple, because why not? And since we're all about gender equality, the brand also offers kits for cloning other body parts. I'd say the name, but this is a family-friendly podcast-ish. To learn more about how Clone a Willy works and to purchase your very own, head to cloneawilly.com and use promo code SHUTUPEVAN for 20% off your order. That's promo code SHUTUPEVAN. Can I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
I'm curious.
Could you shut up, Evan?
One thing I was thinking about.
Shut up, Evan.
So there are some rumors out there.
Evan, shut up.
Is it okay if I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
Okay, but can I just.
Shut up, Evan.
I didn't even say anything. In the words of Valerie Cherish, hello, hello, hello. We are back once again. Shut up, Evan. Season 4 continues. I'm Evan Ross Katz. Sean, hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Long time no talk.
Long time no talk. We're literally like on a podcast recording binge. This is touchdown number 3. We have touchdown? What? This is number 3. We have one more to go in this long sprint. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. I'm about to dive into And Just Like That season 2, so.
Yes, and also we should note, we were recording this on Thursday. Today is the season 2 premiere day of And Just Like That. 2 new episodes have landed on the Max app, and I gotta say, I don't know what Christmas morning is all about, but this feels akin to what I imagine that sensation is. And like, I've seen both episodes, I've watched them twice, I've had the screeners now for over a week, but there's something about it existing in the world now that has me kind of joyous.
Yeah, well, but hey, by the time this comes out, our recap of the first 2 episodes will be available on Drop Your Buffs, for better or for worse.
I am going to go in the direction of for better. I will say I did a roundup on my Substack of like all of the reviews, and at first I just was like curious myself about what the reviews would be. I hate the word polarizing, but like that was what this was to a T, which was that like everyone was either like season 2 has fixed the problem of season 1 or season 2 is fucking awful. And so I just sort of wanted to like put that all into one document together to sort of like underline what I saw as being a very obvious point about the polarization of this show. So that is available in my Substack. But yes, as mentioned, we will be talking all things And Just Like That season 2. And because 2 episodes have dropped today, that means twice the amount of recording for you and I this afternoon. But listen, I'm looking forward to it. I'm heading to Paris this evening. And so the last thing I will be doing before I pack will be talking on the microphone about And Just Like That. What could be better?
Literally.
And you don't know this, but And Just Like That and Sex and the City are famously very Parisian, not centric, but like Paris is a big part of SATC AJLT lore.
That doesn't surprise me.
We've got some ashes in the Seine. Not going to tell you whose.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think I always assumed this because I felt like this was the big connection for like why Lauren Conrad thought about going to Paris.
That would make sense. Yeah. And what's interesting is like it's a big focal point in season 6 of the series, which is the final season of Sex and the City. But then, you know, because And Just Like That is a sequel series, it all comes back.
So somebody's ashes are in the scent. Is it somebody that I've met on Sex and the City?
Yes. Kind of a twist, right?
Wow. Poor Charlotte.
Poor Charlotte. No, I can say confidently Charlotte has made it and is definitely, I think, will be the, from the two episodes that I've screened so far, the most interesting character to dissect from And Just Like That season 2. So more on that later. But we're actually here today to talk about a show that became on my radar, as so many shows do in the modern times, through just like enough people saying the title to me to have it stick in my head. I didn't even correlate the fact that it is an episode. So let's just say it. It's the season 6 premiere episode of Black Mirror. It's titled Joan is Awful. I think there's something about that title that is very fun to say. Mm-hmm. And I think I just kept seeing it ad nauseum, agnostic of any like kind of review, just people saying Joan is awful, which then made me curious to go and seek out, you know, more of an understanding of the conversation. And I was really intrigued by the premise and then people's reaction to it. And it seemed like the kind of show that was very ripe for discussion. What did you know of Joan is Awful prior to diving in?
I actually knew nothing. And I'm a big Black Mirror fan. I've seen every episode as they've come out. And so I was looking forward to this, but I'm one of those people that canceled their Netflix. So I canceled Netflix a few months ago and I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm missing Black Mirror. And then I started to hear Joan is Awful, heard a little bit of, like, I heard the title, didn't hear anything about the episode. And then you wanted to talk about it. And I was like, great, I have a reason to resubscribe to Netflix and watch Black Mirror. So now I've seen it.
I, too, resubscribed to Netflix last night.
Wow, they got us.
Joan is Awful. You know, at one point, I was doing a story for, I think it was GQ, for an actor that was appearing on a Netflix show. And they were like, we'll send you screeners into your Netflix account. And, like, I had to email this, like, long chain of people. Also, mind you, I'm a former Netflix employee to top it all off. And I had to email back and just be like, I'm so sorry, I don't have Netflix. But the more I thought about it, I was like, who are they to like assume that like just everyone has Netflix and you just drop it into like the Netflix bank? But then again, now I do have Netflix. How long do you plan to stay on the platform? I'm undecided.
I'm giving it a month. So I'm going to watch the Black Mirrors. I'm going to watch a couple other things I've missed out on.
Okay.
And I'm going to cancel again.
What's on the docket of things you've missed out on?
What is that one? The Murdaugh Mysteries? Or no, that's the Murdaugh Murders? The Murdaugh Murders.
Like Murdaugh? Like Rupert Murdaugh?
No, it's like, I think it's Murdaugh. Murdaugh. D-A-U-G-H.
Got it.
People were talking about that one. I do love a true crime doc. So that one is on there. I might rewatch a couple episodes of The Latest Selling Sunset, which I already watched on somebody else's account.
I've heard that season 6 that's currently airing? Of Yeah. I heard that it's a return to form.
It is a gag. Do you know what they did with it? They just a tangent for a second. They've lost their villain. They've lost their main villain, Christine Quinn. And so what they did was go to the Oppenheimer group, find somebody who's worked there for 8 years, who has never been mentioned on the show, never appeared on the show, and cast her to drag up all this old drama. And it's literally incredible. It's like, I can't believe this person has been sitting here in the shadows for this long because she is reality TV gold.
Do you know what this makes me think of is Kathy Hilton on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, who had sort of been in the background of so many scenes through the years and is obviously connected to the women. She's the sister of two original cast members of Beverly Hills. But then all of a sudden in like, I think it was season 10, finally like came on the show in like in a formal capacity and then became like the crown jewel of Beverly Hills, despite the fact that she'd been in the background forever. I'm all for a show successfully refreshing itself. Am I gonna watch it? Yeah. I have to say, I did watch the last season of Selling Sunset because this was when I worked at Netflix, and there was the character Chelsea who joined last season, who's now, I'm assuming, a mainstay at this point. Because it takes one season on these shows to really establish, like, OG status these days.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of posts about her fashions this season. I find what's interesting about selling Sunset is that there's like a division in the fan base. And maybe this is true of so much reality, but like of like earnest watchers and like people watching it mining for camp. And I, again, we're using camp with air quotes because camp has devolved in meaning. But like, so I just think there's like those two factions of viewers of like people that genuinely find these women aspirational or cool. And then the other half that's like finds them like anthropologically engaging or like so ridiculous that like we want to watch them fail, which actually is a nice connector over to Joan is Awful. But before I take us on that bridge, are you going to watch Beef?
Yeah, sure. I actually forgot about that. Look, this is the thing. Yeah, now I completely didn't know that that was a thing for 3 milliseconds when you said that. And then I remembered that everybody was talking about Beef. So yeah, I'll watch Beef.
You gotta have the Beef.
What is it, a movie or
it's a show? Series with Ali Wong and Steven Yeun. 10 parts, but really, really rewarding. I think something that you would really enjoy. So we're both on Netflix, but our loyalties remain. Well, my loyalties are with Max. Do you have a loyalty in terms of your streaming platform?
Well, yeah. So in Canada, we don't have Max or Hulu or anything like that. So the big one here is Crave, and they carry all of the HBOs. They are the exclusive carrier and developer now of The Traitors Canada. So all of The Traitors versions. So they've got some good reality. They've got all the HBOs. And so it's Crave, Crave, Crave. Like, I canceled my Netflix because Crave is so robust.
It's all the Crave. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk Joan is Awful. So you mentioned you're a big Black Mirror fan. I'm a big Black Mirror fan. I would say I've only seen probably like 60% of them, though.
Okay.
There's a lot of the, you know, the do not pass episodes, such as I feel like San Junipero is one. Bandersnatch is one. Mm-hmm. What's the big one with Bryce Dallas Howard?
But that's the one where they're rating everyone socially.
Yeah. She's on the episode Nosedive. I feel like Nosedive is a particularly good entry point into the series. If you're looking for something with a little bit of oomph in terms of like what it's saying about society that's not going to force you to, like, really mine it. And I mean that in the best way possible. Nosedive is just, like, very entertaining, but then also kind of, like, hits you with the undercurrent of what it's really getting at.
There's kind of two sort of archetype episodes of Black Mirror. One is the sort of social commentary speculative fiction that is Nosedive, and I would say Joan is Awful. And then there's the horror sort of sci-fi. And I've always leaned more towards the horror, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Do you remember the robot dogs?
Yes.
That was scary.
My very favorite is, it's a season 2 episode, I think it's called White Bear.
White Bear!
Do you know it?
Yeah.
This woman wakes up with amnesia and people are filming her and hunting her.
Wait, stop. I feel like White Bear is the best episode of Black Mirror for like, it's an if you know, you know best episode.
Yes.
I'm glad you brought that up.
It's so funny. Unsettling.
Wait, that was like on my mind of episodes to name when I was like naming the great episodes, but I was like, that's not, it's not like a canonical episode of Black Mirror in the way that like San Junipero, okay, much in the same way that like Joan is Awful is going to be known as Joan is Awful to a lot of people that will never know that it exists under the Black Mirror umbrella. And I feel that way about San Junipero as well, where it's like, its own entity. Whereas White Bear is like that thing that for like, big Black Mirror fans. LOL me saying I've seen 60% of Black Mirror, but it's like, this is for the real ones.
Well, I think also season 2 was pre-Netflix. So I think it's a little bit hidden for some people who maybe came to it in later seasons.
Right.
And haven't worked their way back.
This Joan is Awful also got on my radar, credit to viral marketing, right? But Annie Murphy and Selma Hayek, who are the two stars of Joan is Awful, they appeared during a live taping of Trixie and Katya's show in New York City. And I remember thinking, like, what are these two doing here and why are they together and what's this connection? Is this like a 30 Rock Schitt's Creek crossover? And as it turns out, they are in this new Netflix series. Trixie and Katya have a Netflix series. It's all synergistic. Mm-hmm. But let's start up top by sort of giving a little rundown of what Joan is Afraid is. So Joan is Afraid follows
Joan is Awful.
Wait, what is something?
Beau is afraid.
Beau is afraid. Do you want to know something? I was like thinking, like, what are the great blank is blank titles? And I actually had that question as I was watching Beau is Afraid, Joan is Awful. Do any come to mind for you? Blank is blank.
No.
Well, okay, so I know that there's like Kevin is.
Oh.
Kevin can fuck himself, which also stars Annie Murphy.
Whoa.
Wow. That's some Black Mirror shit. Anyway, if I'm sure those listening are coming up with their great blank is blank in this moment. But anyway, Joan is Awful follows a tech executive played by Annie Murphy who discovers that her life is being adapted into a series by the streaming corporation Streamberry and starring Selma Hayek as Joan, produced entirely in CGI using a quantum computer that gathers real-time data on users' lives from their personal devices. Both Jones, Murphy, and Hayek team up to take down the CEO of Streamberry by destroying the quantum computer.
Spoiler.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We're going to be spoiling. This is an ongoing conversation on this podcast and beyond. Obviously, yes, it is a spoiler by way of, like, plot. I feel like now that I know what happens, I'm actually inclined to watch it again.
Sure.
More now in knowing what happens. I think that there are some shows where, like, the reveal is never going to hit the second time. I actually feel like mm-hmm. the reveal in this instance in like spawns more reason to go back and rewatch it. I imagine there's some Easter eggs laid throughout. So, but yeah, on the surface, spoiler, much in the way that I spoiled Succession for you last week.
Yeah, which actually I still don't know what you said.
Great.
Let's not talk about it.
I'll tell you this much. Whoever dies in Succession, their ashes are not in the Seine.
Oh, okay. So there's no crossover.
No crossover. In terms of the plot of Joan, I keep wanting to say Joan is afraid. I mean, she is afraid at times.
She's scared.
Yeah. But mostly she's awful. But she's not that awful. But we'll get to that.
That's the thing. Yeah.
But I think that that's purposeful. So anyway, what are your overall top level thoughts on this hour-long episode of Black Mirror?
Can I be a little negative?
Yeah.
I think it's a fine piece of television. Do I think it's a great Black Mirror episode? No. I think they've done this better in the past. And I felt like they were leaning into comedy a little bit in a way that I don't expect from Black Mirror and didn't necessarily land with me. Like, I wasn't laughing at the jokes, you know?
Yeah.
Selma Hayek saying, doesn't my anus have rights? I don't find it that funny. I could see that people would find it funny. It's just not for me.
It was one of those moments where I could imagine the crew all bursting out laughing after the take and her feeling very self-satisfied. It felt like it was written to be funny in a way. But from what I've read about the making of the show, it was actually Selma who, like, wanted the character to be more absurd. I couldn't help but think about James Marsden in Jury Duty throughout this, because there's a little bit of, like, from what I've read of Selma's interviews, of her being like, I want that perception of, like, that people think I take myself too seriously to be blown up. And as I was reading that, I was like, is that really, like, people's perception of Selma Hayek? More, I just think she's, like, a great actor and really wealthy person.
And I feel like we have seen comedy from Selma Hayek before. We've seen her, like,
star of 30 Rock. She's fucking hilarious on 30 Rock. Same with James Marsden. There's so many connections here.
Oh. There's almost a connection between this and Jury Duty in the conceit.
It's true. What's interesting, too, about this show, from what you're saying, and from, like, the negative lens, is it's very, very well reviewed from most of what I've been reading. I'm more aligned with you in the sense of I enjoyed watching this, and I definitely, like, think that the commentary about the integration of AI is, like, the most interesting part of the show. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, like, ripe for discussion. And I think the timeliness of this is, like, incredible in that this was written months and months and months ago and is coming out now while we're in the midst of a writer's strike that is largely predicated on conversations about the integration of AI in Hollywood, as well as just overall fears of what AI is going to do to civilization, as well as the fact that we have this ongoing conversation sort of about main character energy in social media. How much of that is the real person of who we are? How much are people receiving that as realness? And then how much is that fake version of ourselves? How much does that impact the real version when we start living a life in service of a fake version of ourselves? I mean, like, yeah, there's certainly interesting questions that this brings about. I also, I hope this isn't like a hot take, but like, I didn't love the performances. I thought that they were good. I understand why someone casts Annie Murphy, and I would definitely give her like, I'd give her two thumbs up in this performance, but the metric's just two thumbs, right? I didn't have the context of Schitt's Creek, I don't think I would walk away from this episode thinking much about her character or her performance.
Yeah, I agree with you on this. And I think with Selma Hayek is a great actress, as we all know, but I did find the entire thing a little two-dimensional. And it's also distracting for a Black Mirror episode to have stars, like big stars, right? We usually get, I mean, you get the odd and you get the Bryce Dallas Howard, but usually we're not like infiltrating really big stars into this show.
Is that true?
I think so. Like, I mean, prove me wrong. I mean, I think John Hamm was in the
group. I was going to say, we have John Hamm.
But like, it's like outlier. Like, those are outliers.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think there's some easy pushback here. I mean, I'm seeing Jesse Plemons, Daniel Kaluuya, Letitia Wright.
This might be about me not knowing who anybody is.
But I know what you mean. This is a show that it's a premise-based show and not a check out the cast list that we were able to get. Which is funny that you say that, because I was just looking at the fact that Nine Perfect Strangers, which is that Nicole Kidman Hulu series that kind of came and went, is actually coming back. And they got Dolly De Leon from Triangle of Sadness and R. King Murray Bartlett. And as I was thinking, it's like, oh, it's Murray Bartlett, I'll be watching. But then I was like, basically, there's like this category of show that comes out now where it's just, I think it like, maybe like Big Little Lies was the beginning of this. Maybe it's before that. But like, basically, it's like they just get a bunch of A-list actors, many of whom you would not expect to be doing television, which was at one time Nicole Kidman. And then it just sort of exists. And sometimes it has impact, but other times not at all. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating. And then you sort of have like the second category, which is like sort of like your White Lotuses, which give you like actors that you know, but like aren't top of mind for you, a la like an F. Murray Abraham or a Michael Imperioli, who are like beloved character actors, but then like gives them the chance to like chew the scenery or like, you know, just give a dimension of performance they've never given before.
Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe I can walk back my statement that Black Mirror isn't a vehicle for big stars, but I think what's jarring here is that Selma Hayek is playing Selma Hayek.
Right.
And that's unusual for a Black Mirror, I would say.
Right. But then she's playing, like, I think in her mind, right, she's playing a version of herself.
Of course.
But it's almost like she takes that version and, like, points at the fact that it's such a version. It could have benefited from being a bit more real Selma versus, like, the character of Selma.
Yeah.
But then again, she was never Selma all along. So true. To that point, I think you'd be better at this than I would. Can you sort of, I mean, like, I explained like the plot of the show, but can you sort of explain for people what's going on? Can I task you with that?
Yeah, I guess I can give it my best shot. So essentially, Joan's life is being made into a Streamberry show with a new episode every day. And it's highlighting the moments in her day where she's awful, essentially. Is it an interesting TV show? I think that's up for debate. Why people are tuning in every day? Up for debate. But that is the premise. And so she is being played by Selma Hayek in the Streamberry show. But in the Streamberry show, Selma Hayek discovers the show Joan is awful. And in that version, Cate Blanchett is playing Joan.
Which we're sadly robbed of scenes of.
Yeah, truly.
I felt like we could have just gotten like a single Cate Blanchett as Joan scene. Yeah.
If we're going to do stars, let's do stars.
Stars.
And so it leads you to believe that there is an infinite number of Joan is awfuls played by different people, each for their own. And what we find out towards the end is that they are all AI generated in a quantum computer. And that, in fact, the Joan we've been following isn't even the original Joan. And so it is simply an AI simulation, and she is coming to terms with the fact that she is not real. And if she takes actions to destroy this quantum computer, then she will cease to exist.
And it should be noted here that it all comes down to what is referred to as Source Joan.
Yes.
Which is the OG Joan, who is sort of like the least camera ready, given like each one is sort of building on the characteristics of the other one and sort of dramatized in a way because they want to make it as streamable as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I had a moment. I went to this like sad dermatologist earlier this week. I was like, I don't know about you, but I was trying to find just like the closest doctor to my apartment.
Right, sure.
And so
that's what I do with massages.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's sensible in theory. And like, I like the neighborhood I live in. And I was like, you know, but I don't live in a neighborhood known for doctors, you know?
Uh-huh.
And now I know why. But anyway, this was just a really like, it was the first floor of a brownstone, which sounds like really ritzy. But like, this was a doctor who I entered the door and I felt transported to like a different time period in terms of like just how the world functions. But as I was watching Source Joan and Joan is Afraid, I was like, this is my Source Joan moment. Like the thing that like, I can't believe that I have to have this be a part of my day where I'm sitting in for 45 minutes in this ultra sad waiting room, which is on the first floor of this brownstone, but there's no windows. And then the doctor himself, like, I needed him to like look. I had this little rash on the back of my ankle, in the back of my knee. I needed him to look at it, and I was wearing shorts. And he was like, "Well, let me step out of the room while you change." And I was like, "I can literally just. It's on the back of my knee, like it's right here." So then I took my clothes off, not all my clothes, but like I took some of my clothes off. Then he leaves the room, was gone for like 5 minutes, then comes back. Then when he finally sees it. Then he leaves the room to let me change again. He's gone for like a whole 5 minutes. Anyway, I bring this up because I understand Source Joan behavior. I'm actually really fascinated by the idea of like, you know, we talked about main characters earlier, but it's like main characters have those moments where they're in a waiting room for 45 minutes or, you know, they are sitting in the doctor's office while the doctor is typing away on his computer when he should be taking care of you. It's interesting to think about the down moments, right? Like thinking about like when someone takes a selfie, for instance, with people, and it's like you have that moment where like everyone activates in a way. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And then
sure.
It's like it's over and everyone powers down. I'm really like fascinated by like our existences in power down states, especially by those people who were accustomed to seeing powered on.
But this is the thing with Joan is Awful is I don't think they really show her in the powered down state in the TV show. Because we're getting glimpses of her firing somebody. We're getting her therapy session. We're getting her, like, flirting with her ex-boyfriend.
Right.
And all of those things, I think, they all have awful elements to them. And so you can see that Joan is awful. But it's, like, it's not the most awful.
No. I mean, thinking about the very first scene that we see of Joan is her having to fire one of her employees. Mm-hmm. But it's, like, she didn't, like, want to fire the employee. In fact, you see her like really being like struggling to have to make this decision. Certainly she was like slightly callous about it, but you could also argue that that's like she's at work, so she needs to be as unemotional as possible when firing someone.
I do love the scene of flicking her vape off the railing.
I like the sound effect of when it hit Aoedipus' head. But also, that was like one of those instances of like, for what? Like, what is this? Like, what is the detail here?
Here's what's confusing to me about the concept is that for what is so that when Selma Hayek does it, it can look malicious.
Mm-hmm.
But if we trace this back, now that we know that our Joan isn't Source Joan, and I'm only assuming that our Joan is the Joan that is on Source Joan's TV. We don't even know that, I think, for sure, because she could be levels up or levels down. But let's say our Joan is the Joan on Source Joan's Streamberry.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's not exaggerated enough, right? Because Source Joan would be watching this Joan accidentally flick the vape off the balcony, where our Joan watched Selma Hayek maliciously flick the vape off the balcony. But nobody's seeing that because that's an AI Joan watching an AI Joan. And, you know, nobody's ever seen the Cate Blanchett version because our Joan never watches it. And if our Joan is on Source Joan's Streamberry, we're never seeing the Cate Blanchett. Nobody in real world is ever seeing the Cate Blanchett version. Do you know what I'm saying?
Only on the Selma Hayek level. And yes. Selma's not watching.
But that's what I'm saying is Selma Hayek is fake, right? So if we're talking the real world, nobody in the real world will ever see that unless our Joan watches it. Then it's on Source Joan's Streamberry.
I guess my question is when something gets this layered, this reminds me of like when you and I are talking like Survivor and it's like there'll be like something that's like deeply strategic of like if this person switched their vote to blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I like make a joke on Drop Your Buffs where I'll just be like, well, at this point, I'm just like tuning out. I do wonder when we get into like these multiverses and these sort of like, well, if this is like, there's almost this, it gets so layered that I do think there's a point at which it's like everything you said just now, I do understand on a fundamental level, but like, is it impacting like my greater understanding of the story of this? To me, it's like, I know that there's Source Joan. I know that there's Annie Murphy Joan. And then I know that there's like Jones on Jones on Jones. Real quick, just to deviate, who would you want to see playing Cate Blanchett's Joan?
Oh my gosh.
Cate Blanchett's on screen Joan.
I don't know.
It's hard because it's like we're talking like one of the greatest actors of all time.
I would like to see Gwyneth Paltrow play Cate Blanchett's Joan.
Okay.
I think Gwyneth Paltrow would be a great Joan. She's almost already Joan.
I was going to say, there's Joan, like, Qualy Stewart.
How about Gwen is awful?
I'm tuning in. I would cast Tilda Swinton as Joan in Cate Blanchett's Joan is awful.
I wonder, does it become more cartoony as we go up the chain?
Well, that's interesting though, because I guess again we were robbed of seeing Kate's interpretation of Joan, but I do think it's pointed why Joan is not in fact awful, because at first I'm watching it being like she's not that awful, but then I come to understand the fact that like that's kind of the point. Basically, like the dramatization is basically the equivalent of a bad faith argument, right? Which is that like we see Joan do something that on the surface might not read well. It's like she callously fired an employee. Here I am being like, well, the reason she did that is there, you know, is because blah, blah, blah. But basically the show eliminates the context and it's basically like Joan callously fired one of her employees who really was working really, really hard and needed the job, blah, blah, blah. And then she's having an affair. I also felt like with regards to her affair, so she's, I get it, this is the thing. It's like, is she in an unhappy marriage or she's just in like an ambivalent marriage? Or she's like, yeah, that was sort of unclear to me, the character of Krish, which is her husband.
Yeah.
Because we go, she meets up with her ex-boyfriend at a bar. They share a passionate kiss. He's like, come upstairs. She's like, no, no, no. She basically draws the line there and goes home. But it's unclear whether or not that affair is sort of just like a yes and. Like, I'm in my marriage and I'd like a little bit on the side. Or if it's I'm in an unhappy marriage and this is something that's the one thrill that I get to have. And I feel like that kind of either could have been mined more or maybe we... There was another way to approach that because I felt like it lingered for me throughout the show.
Yeah, I do think that the show sort of stepped away as soon as the sci-fi element to this was introduced. And that was that Streamberry is listening to all of her devices and then creating a show about it, which we'll get to in a second. But I feel like as soon as that's introduced, the human story took a backseat. Right. So the story of her relationship, like none of that was pursued. It was suddenly like a buddy like heist movie with Selma Hayek.
And also I couldn't help but wonder, like, as soon as we learned that it was the devices, I was like, why not chuck your phone,
throw it in a river, throw it in the Seine?
Or it was sort of like I kept thinking about like the Truman Show, and it was like, why not like get in your car and like start driving, girl? Like it seemed odd that she wasn't trying to make bigger decisions outside of, like, I mean, eventually they land on the decision, her and Selma link up and decide to, like, go into the headquarters and try and, like, solve this once and for all. But I feel like the first decision that would be made when you run into this sort of problem, rather than attack it head on, is to run away from it. And I was surprised that we didn't get that and come up against, like, it felt like there was a character that was supposed to reroute her back into her life.
Yeah, it would have been interesting had she sort of destroyed her devices so that they couldn't listen to her anymore. Then they have no content to work with for the next day. So then they start making stuff up and it's worse than real life, right? Then it's like, I have no choice. Like I am stuck in this and I need to be a better version of myself or something. Like there's a rabbit hole we could have gone down that I think might've been more interesting if anyone needs a writer once the strike is over.
Right, and not an AI writer. But then we veer into Joan is afraid instead of Joan is awful territory, which I love.
Yeah, truly, truly.
Then the Ari Aster comes into play, and it really, really gets twisted. Hey, I'm into that. I am curious.
I'm changing my major to Joan.
Joan.
That's all I had going through my head watching this episode was Joan, 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 Joan.
It's true. That, or I was doing just a reinterpretation of June is busting out all over, but Joan is busting out all over. But yes. Joan, 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 Joan. Yes, no, indeed. Two other things I want to touch down on before we wrap it up, but there's obviously what I think is going to be like the memed moment in the show, if you will, which is that she consumes a bunch of burgers and then downs laxatives and then walks into a random person's wedding and decides to shit all over the floor. And the idea being that Joan is making an effort to torpedo her show to get the attention of Selma Hayek in real life. Uh-huh. Selma Hayek has given over her CGI self to Streamberry. And Annie Murphy's character, Annie Murphy's Joan, is trying to say, like, if you give up your rights, I can do anything I want, and you're the one that's going to have to, you know, live it out as you or as this CGI version of you. So how can I sort of defecate, for lack of a better word, all over your image? And this is certainly like the scene people are talking about. If you look at headlines about the show, it's like showrunner talks about the poop. What did you make of that sequence?
Black Mirror, I think, doesn't verge typically into this corny of territory. And so, like, was it, like, well done and well presented? Yes, I can see why it would be memed out or why this is the moment that people would be talking about. But for me, it was, like, a little over the top and not even necessarily that clear as to the strategy. I felt like there was more she could have done and we could have made it more Black Mirror and like maybe she murders somebody or like let's go full tilt.
I was gonna say she needed to do something to get her canceled. Like I feel like that is the route you go versus just something gross, because gross goes viral. But I guess in her mind she was like virality would ultimately maybe get Selma's attention. I also felt like the fact that it was a random person's wedding was hard to like understand. I wanted it to be like Krish's wedding. It's like 6 months later and he's with his new wife. And then also she puts her hair in ponytails and then like marks up her face, her forehead with lipstick, was that supposed to be a dick?
Yeah.
Okay. Like for what? Like the centerpiece of this is the defecation. I don't think like the hair and pigtails is like what is that meant to convey?
Yeah, and it just goes to show she's not a Selma Hayek fan, because we all know that Selma Hayek has taken on a shit monster in the film Dogma. Very famously.
Wow, I had forgotten about that, but that's very true.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the ending briefly. So basically they infiltrate Streamberry. Or rather Annie Murphy's Joan destroys the quantum computer.
Uh-huh.
And then it is revealed that the source Joan is standing there and it's Annie Murphy then as the Selma Hayek Joan.
Yeah.
And then that Joan is, then Source Joan is escorted off the premises and then starts to smile, which is very, reminded me of like the final shot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when it's like the final stage direction is like Buffy like begins to smile. And it was like very much like that energy of like, there's another show actually that did it recently too, where it's just like the promise of like a new beginning.
You know who would have done this premise really well? Buffy.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny you say that. Yes, the show would have done this very, very well. But also, Sarah Michelle Gellar would have bodied Joan.
Oh, yeah.
This was like exactly the kind of role that I want for her. Yes. That I feel like she would be, oh, like, because, you know, I'm always casting Sarah in my mind of like, oh, she could be that. Like, this is SMG, and it would be the right amount of like dexterous for her. And also, I feel like she can calibrate this kind of comedy perfectly.
There is a universe in which Joan is played by Sarah Michelle Gellar.
It's the one above Annie Murphy, I'm telling you that much. But then we get this sort of like coda afterwards, and both the Source Joan and Annie Murphy meet up at a coffee shop where Source Joan is working, and they kind of like, they're laughing together, and the camera pans down and we see that they're both wearing ankle monitors. And so the idea is that like they've in fact become friends. And I was reading an interview with the director of this episode and sort of talked about like the feminist message that they wanted sort of implicitly within the show, and the importance of female friendship. And I agree with all of that. I'm not sure that, like, this was giving that. But they're ultimately banding together to take down a woman. I thought the choice of a woman CEO was, like, strangely, like, pointed, despite the fact that it's, like, seemingly incongruous to their intent. But also, like, their friendship, the Selma Hayek and Annie Murphy Jones, is, like, predicated not on their, like, love for one another, but their desire to service themselves.
Yes. I think it's a stretch. I think it's a stretch to like find the feminist throughway here.
I did as well.
Do you know what the problem with this episode is? It's going to launch millions of Facebook statuses of like, you know, when like a mom puts a Facebook status and it's like, starting tomorrow, Facebook will steal all of our data and I do not give permission. It's coming back, I think, thanks to this episode.
Yes.
I feel like that's the target audience for this episode.
Yes.
And they'll eat it up.
They will eat it up like those burgers. Let's wrap this up by just talking about the choice of those burgers. If you were in a situation in which you were going to defecate all over a random Roman Catholic wedding because you wanted to get the attention of the actor playing you on a streaming service. Well, first of all, who's playing Sean on Streamberries?
Oh, Lord.
Sean is awful.
Well, you tell me.
I tell you who's playing you?
Yeah. As you know, I famously can't name an actor. I can't name a man.
Okay, well, the example that always comes to mind for me whenever someone says someone should play someone, oh, then this will go over your head, but basically they play this game on Sex and the City, and Stanford, Carrie's gay best friend who you met in the premiere episode, asks Carrie who should play him in a movie, and Carrie says a young Ed Harris. And so I always just think of that line. So whenever someone says who should play someone, I always think a young Ed Harris. So that is who I'm casting in Shaun is Afraid.
Is Stanford dead in the Sen?
Stanford is not dead in the Sen. Stanford is in Japan.
Okay. I've only met so many people.
You do know that the actor that plays Stanford is dead.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a young Ed Harris it is.
And then famously Anthony, who you haven't met. If Stanford is Carrie's gay, Anthony is Charlotte's gay, and Anthony responds, Ed Harris, try Ed, I have no Harris, which I just love. Okay, so I'm casting Ed Harris. Who are you casting as me in Evan is Awful?
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Thank you. Okay, now, if you were to be in a situation, you gotta binge eat some food in order to defecate, like I said, all over the Roman Catholic, random, blah, blah, blah. What are you eating?
Well, she takes laxative with it.
Yeah.
Right, so I can do that too. I would do like a nice, like rich curry. Like a creamy, cream-based curry.
That makes sense.
And then I'd smoke a pack of cigarettes too. Ugh.
The thing that's odd about the burger, because I do love a burger, but like a burger is never something, you don't finish a burger and say, hey, I want another one.
No.
Whereas like curry is one of those things where it's like you could just keep taking more and more spoonfuls.
Oh my God. And yeah, different flavors.
Right. Or like I'm thinking about like pizza is like another obvious answer where it's like you don't have one slice of pizza, you know?
But pizza's not coming right out.
I agree. Well, I'm not advocating for pizza. I will advocate though for like whatever you do have. First of all, she should be having Taco Bell. Like, let's be serious.
Oh, good one.
But also just like have some coffee with it.
Seriously, coffee and like a vape.
Yeah.
Let's get it moving.
But yeah, I can't help but think it's like, I mean, just to go back, it's like there are so many other things she could have done that are like way more over the top that yeah, I think would have generated more conversation in the world of Joan is Awful and in the greater social media conversation.
Yeah.
What does someone do when they're attempting to get canceled is such an interesting question.
Totally. But it's like in Jury Duty when he's trying to get out of jury duty. And so he's like, well, I'll say I'm racist.
Absolutely. So I would say ultimately, I would recommend this episode. I think it's definitely interesting to watch. Yeah. And I've definitely enjoyed like reading up about it. And I definitely think this is going to propel Annie Murphy's career forward in that she's one of those actors who's like regarded for like one role and one role only. And I feel like this is that moment where it's suddenly like, oh, she can do other things. Now, I recognize the fact that, like, I'm not, like, over the moon about her in this episode, but I definitely, like, think that this will open doors, and I'm open to the idea of her wowing me. It's not that I think she was bad in this at all. I just don't think this was a breakout moment in the way that, oh, like, Bryce Dallas Howard on Black Mirror, for me, was a real revelation in terms of her prowess as, like, a leading lady.
Yeah. I think it just wasn't that. I think the problem with the episode for an actress is that it just wasn't character focused enough, despite the title of Joan is Awful, which you would imagine would be highly, highly character focused. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of character development. It was very plot driven.
Also, here's a question. Is there any world in which you think that this show or this episode would have been better suited as a movie? Because interestingly, this is a long episode of television. It's a full hour.
We've had longer episodes of Black Mirror.
Right, they have. But I wonder if we push this into like a 90 minute, if we would have been able to get into the necessary character development.
Absolutely.
The episode, like the first 10 or 15 minutes took a long time to like get going.
Yeah, I did take one TikTok break.
Yeah. Ugh, you and your TikTok breaks. Anywho, well, that is Joan is Awful. It's on Netflix for those of you that subscribe. But from one pretty good episode of television to what I can easily call the best film that I saw so far this year. The film is called Past Lives. Its star is Greta Lee. I have wanted her on this podcast since season one, and I finally got her, and what a get. So when we come back from our break, I am joined by what I feel confident, I don't want to say it because it's going to jinx it. I'm going to say this, what I feel confident will be a very award-celebrated role in her new film, Past Lives, the unequaled Greta Lee.
Shut up, Evan. Hi, yay, yay.
Hi, yay, yay.
Are you in LA?
I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Like, you're based in LA, right?
No, I'm very much a New Yorker.
So I said that to someone, and someone corrected me, and they said, no, I think he's in LA.
Not only that, but, I mean, I was in the East Village for 11 years, so much of where you shot Past Lives and the apartment on First Street, all very, very familiar territory.
Okay. Well, without, you know, revealing your full address, but for years I was on like 2nd between 5th and 6th. I was on 11th between A and B.
I was on 7th between 1st and 2nd.
You were?
I'm sure there's like a moment in time where like we could sliding doors it and like we walked past one another, you know?
I'm sure. Yes, absolutely.
But yes, I feel like First Street is now your street because I will never, well, I between the carousel in Dumbo and First Street, I feel like you now own certain parts of New York City.
Thank you so much. I'm like the Donald Trump of certain parts of the village.
Yeah, you really are. I am so excited to have you here for a myriad of reasons, but above all, because I really want to talk about this movie. We ran into each other briefly at a Loewe dinner, and I didn't want to hound you, but it's a movie that needs to be spoken about, and who better to speak about it with than the star of the film? Greta, I'm so honored to have you.
I'm so honored to be here, truly. I'm so excited. My best gay, who's also named Evan, was fangirling out, shout out Evan, when the first post that you put up about the movie, and he was like, can you, do you know this? This is important. Do you see what's happening? But I've loved you for so long, and this is so cool.
That's so sweet. I'm loving all of the love that the film has been getting online. Pedro Pascal, Kirsten Dunst, so many great celebrities are shouting out this film. I'm wondering what it feels like from your perspective to see fellow actors honoring a work, because I don't see a lot of actors touting other actors' projects very often.
Because actors are petty bitches.
Yeah, that's why.
Or self-serving little bitches. It's so overwhelming, honestly. I don't even know. I can't pretend and even make sense of it. It's so incredible. And like, if I didn't find a way to just enjoy this on some level, like I would be a supreme asshole. Like there's certain moments when you just have to grab it and say, thank you so much. And find the joy in it. And that is what I'm actively trying to do. And I'd be lying if I didn't say like this feels entirely like science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think processing our experiences in real time is not always the most like fruitful pursuit.
Okay, I totally agree. I feel like now too, there's something culturally where there's like, because we're in the era of me, there's this unnatural thing happening where there's this expectation to create your narrative, to like instantly understand what is happening to you in the moment and connect all of the dots in this very like convenient way, this accessible, palatable way, and then be able to serve it up for everyone. And like, I'm so allergic to that. Like, what happened to the messiness of like, I have no fucking idea what's happening right now. And that's part of it. You know, like I don't want to know. I don't want to understand everything perfectly.
And you know, the irony of it all is that is ultimately the most relatable attribute. And so many people try and like feign or like construct relatability in this me era, as you say. And it's like, if we were to just be honest about the fact that we're all just fucking figuring it out, maybe we'd actually get somewhere.
I think so. I think this would be a less embarrassing time for humans if we could just do that better.
It is embarrassing. I do want to start off with a hard-hitting and extremely topical question.
Right.
I've always been bothered by the fact that your character, Soo Jin, on HBO's Girls, wasn't given a proper send-off. She returns in season 3 as a gallerist, and it's made to seem like she's going to be around for a while. Then she says she has to go to therapy, and we never see her again. It bothers me. Where did Soo Jin go?
Should we call Lena?
Yeah, right now.
What time is it? Is she in London? Where is she?
She's around.
That's funny that you felt that way, that you felt like she was going to come back around. So we've heard this description of Soo Jin, like she's like one of the premier and earliest examples of Nepo babies.
I'm opening my own gallery.
Are you serious?
It's been such a fucking whirlwind. Literally don't have time to breathe. And I'm dirt poor now. It's so sad.
Well, you went shopping.
Oh no, this is just a tax write-off. All my money has been going to the space and the publicity, and my parents are ready to murder me. But it's just so freeing to be your own boss, you know?
And props to Lena for tapping into that at that time and space in that way. And in my mind, it's like she was kind of like the bad guy, which I loved. And I think that that's what felt like kind of, I mean, honestly, like badass and fresh about being able to play her in that way, in the way that I wanted to, because she's annoying as shit, but I love that about her, you know? And I know those people, especially at that time in my life when I was just like struggling to, I like moved to New York with this Sex and the City fantasy that just like failed me immediately and became instantly poor because I threw all my money away trying to buy like one Cosmo. But then there are other people in my life who like did feel like they experience walk through life like it was like confetti falling into their laps. Like it just like that kind of ease matched with the supreme unawareness of that ease. I like nothing is funnier to me. Like I love that. And I have a genuine love. Like I have a compassion for that kind of a person. Like I think there's a reason why so many people say like, I love Soo Jin, and it always makes me laugh. Like, I know. I do too.
She also introduced me to rose ice cream. I was not aware of that flavor until Soojin.
Yes.
She had a scoop.
Oh, hey, and Soojin. Yeah. Hey, yesterday, the ice cream that you picked up, it had a tiny bite taken out of it.
Yeah, sorry. I took a tiny scoop. I'd never had rose water ice cream before. It was so good.
Yeah, it is so good. I'm sorry. I kind of find that weird that you opened my ice cream and took a scoop.
Are you serious?
Yeah. She had a scoop. I think, and you know, that's based on a real thing that actually happened. To one of the writer producers of the show at the time, actually had an assistant where that was the incident.
For real?
How can I trust you now, Soojin?
This is total bullshit. I'm sorry I had a tiny scoop of your ice cream. I don't need this job. I don't know why I've been doing it this long. My boyfriend is doing lights for Carly Rae Jepsen, and I should be on the bus with him. And I'm gonna go do that now.
I also love that it spoke to this like entire class of young Asian American women who were fulfilling this role of effective, like high-powered assistant with like an outsized confidence and sense of like entitlement. That like it felt like a subgenre to me to represent this group of people. I know this woman.
Where do you think that she is today? I recognize that you are not the writer, but I'm just saying, if we were to prognosticate, where would you want to see Soojin in 2023?
She's dead.
She's dead.
I mean, I think where she is now, it's like what I want for her. I'm not even sure what I want for her, because I'm not sure if I'm honest, like I don't know if I want to see a woman like that evolve. Mm-hmm. Like my fantasy is that she is now, okay, so like, you know, in her, I guess she'd be in her 40s or, and like, I would love for her to be exactly the same, but I don't know if that's possible, right? It feels like she's too old to exist. Like, so maybe she's just kicking it with a bunch of 20-year-olds somewhere. And she's like the Vera Wang of her surroundings. Like, she's just like, I'm doing this. Like, yeah. 2K, yeah, let me show you. I'm in. Like, I'm gonna show my thong. I'm like, I can hang with the rest of you. Like, maybe she's doing that.
I mean, I do appreciate that her final form as it existed on the show was she's off to therapy in the middle of the workday, because that's what you do. Yeah. You go to therapy. I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for answering that question. It's been gestating in my mind for some time, and I'm glad we got some answers, even if she might be dead. Now, you are one of those actors that always seems to be working. And I mean this, that you are here today to talk about past lives, but I went to a screening of Problemista on Friday, and who shows up on my screen but Greta Lee. And then I come to find out, oh wait, she can't have two movies screening right now. She's also in Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, because God forbid you only did one movie at a time. That wouldn't be enough. How do you find the time?
I don't know, Evan. It's a huge problem. When certain things are great and you just have to do, then, you know, I jump at it. With Problemista, I had already finished Past Lives. I like came home. I think I was like reverberating in my post-Past Lives fucked upness. And then got a call that was like, well, there's like a small part in Julio's movie, and I've loved Julio for so long, with Tilda Swinton. Like, do you think you could kind of get your shit together to run back over here and do that? And, you know, my husband was like, are you for real right now? Like, seriously? I'm like, yeah, Tilda Swinton. Yes, I'll be right back. So there's certain things that like you kind of just have to make yourself available for. And for me, that's Tilda Swinton. But yeah, I like working, I guess.
You're good at it. So it kind of works.
Well, I try to be.
Well, I would say it's a great success. Okay. Now, to pivot to the main event, I try not to think about art as good or bad these days. My metric of sort of judging something, if you will, if that's even the word, is sort of like, does it stay with me? Do I think about it? Do I want to talk about it? And for how long? This is a film I cannot stop thinking about. I cannot. I rewatched the film yesterday in preparation for today, and I began bawling at the end, even before the end, because I knew it was coming. Then I'm bawling at the end, and my fiance asked me, why are you crying? Like, what is the thing making you cry right now? And I couldn't put it into words, but, and this is maybe a spoiler, but at the end, when your character, Nora, begins to cry, her release became my release in that moment. And I'm just wondering about that final sequence and if you could talk about what is captured in the final minutes of this film.
I'm just going to talk about it without being, nervy about spoiling. Whatever. If you're listening to this, this is your chance to tune out. We're going to talk about it. And I also love that on some level, like the thing that we're spoiling is just the fact that she cried.
That's the thing. It's like, is it a spoiler question mark?
Well, so in this case, I would say it is. You know, I have to admit that when I watch it, I cry. Yeah, it's so weird to cry at yourself. Like, I remember the first time I saw it with an audience at Sundance, I like really started to cry. And I felt like really embarrassed because it's like, then we had to get up on stage and it was feeling like, oh my God, you can't cry at your own movie. Like, stop it. And feeling like in a panic about that. But I think that really stems. So it's the movie. The movie fucks you up in that way, in that gorgeous way. I know for me on my end, the process of it, you know, Lord knows I was trying to emote and show you, it's like an acting thing. You want to be able to show like, I can cry. You want me to cry? Like I can cry. But all joking aside, like the full, you want to be able to show what you can do to flex and to be able to like, to do the thing. But this movie was allergic to that. The second you did that, it dies. So what I had to endure was months of just trusting that it's enough to just arrive, like as myself or as Nora, and basically not cry. And I knew at the end, it's in the script that, you know, that she cries. And that was a whole other loaded question of like, what is that? Like, what does that look like? And like, how do you ride the line? What's true in that? This is so scary. I mean, I'm not shying away from how fucking hard it was just to be honest and to calibrate like what is honest? Like what kind of cry is that? How can I convey and let come out of me the full depth of that sadness and that loss without venturing into histrionics or something that feels like melodramatic or false? And there's no way to rehearse that. It's not like I can like go into my room and just like squeeze them out and just experiment to see like what that would even be like. That moment was like skydiving. Like I've never felt that level of like, I have no idea. I'm about to jump off of a plane. Like, I don't know. And that ending was shot in one take, actually. From the moment she leaves the brownstone and then she has her, in the script, 2 minutes of silence before the Uber comes and she says goodbye. And then she walks back home to Arthur and then has this emotional release. We did that in one take. And I remember the first time we did it for real when we were rolling, John Magaro, who plays Arthur, was a little, I want to say like, he was stunned, but like in a way that it made me scared that I had fucked up, that it was like too much. Mm. And then maybe that's right for his character because he's not around for this stuff that I was shooting with Teo. He was like, whoa, like, oh my God. And it made me feel self-conscious that like, oh, it's too much. But that was one of the first moments I think that he understood, right? Like, this is cosmic. Like, this is a no chill moment. This has consequences. This is of substance. This is animalistic. And that's what I have to say about that last scene.
I like hearing about it. I want to talk about Nora. There are so many fabulous details about Nora sort of drizzled throughout this film, if you will. One in particular that I love is when Nora is getting on the ferry. Haesong offers her, he asks her if she's hungry. She says yes. He pulls something out of his backpack. She takes it and immediately bites in. She doesn't ask what it is. And I just feel like so often when people ask you, if you're hungry, like, people just tend to say no. And if they were to be like, do you want something? Everyone's always so polite. No, thank you. Like, thanks for offering, blah, blah, blah. Nora says yes. And then she takes the bite, doesn't even have to know what it is. And it's just moments like that where you learn so much about Nora. I love the way she holds a coffee cup. I'm just wondering if there's a specific detail about Nora that you, Greta, really latched onto.
Well, I love that you picked up on that, like the bagel moment.
It's the bagel, yes.
And that was a very surreal moment. I didn't know Teo at all, really, at that point. We had 2 weeks of rehearsal, which is a lot, actually, compared to some other situations. But that's not enough time to create a soulmate kind of dynamic. But she was smart. Celine was really smart in terms of that the shooting out of sequence in that way, because it really reflected what was in the script at that point when they're reuniting that person, your soulmate, after so many years. There's this like this mystery to them where you're trying to bridge that gap, but then they're this uncanny reflection of a part of you that maybe you had put aside. But anyways, I love that Nora on a lot of levels, like, she's so normal, you know, like I feel like there's so many portraits of modern women that are, yeah, like either scrubbed clean, or you can tell, like, it's in service of this other idea of like what a woman at the center of a love story like should be, to be more palatable or like more like, I don't, just more acceptable. And I love all those moments where she like, she doesn't give a shit. Like, that is not her concern in that moment. She's like, yeah, bagel, hungry, which is so much more recognizable to me. Now, I have to admit, that was the first scene, and I was still on my, like, morning show metronome. I remember finding myself improvising. Like, I had this whole run where, like, I actually, this is why it's so amazing that you picked up on that. Because while I have an understanding of this and why she needs to just eat it, me as an actor, I can fully admit that I failed and fucked that up, because I initially, like, I could not stop improvising. It was like my own nerves of like, oh my God, we're shooting on film. There's so much silence. It's taking so long. Why is the camera still on me? Nothing's happening. Feeling like after years of writing on my feet or whatever it is, doing comedies, doing different kinds of things tonally, I improvise all this bullshit about like Russ and Daughters, like what kind of bagel is this, like schmear, like just full trash. And I remember Celine just saying to me really simply, like, stop, don't do that. I'm playing a character, so I'm not myself, but it's like how scary it was realizing like, oh, I'm really showing parts of my being that I'm just not used to showing. I'm just much more used to performing or making jokes. And I honor those parts of myself. Like I will forever want to be like a song and dance monkey. Like I find a lot of fulfillment in that. But this was like so exposing. I was so uncomfortable.
As you said earlier, like it took you a while to acclimate back into the post past lives world. I think you said it was like a fucked upness that had occurred in you. Your words. I wouldn't call it that. It's just you. But like, I'm wondering, was that a part of that vulnerability that you're sort of speaking to?
Yeah. I had a lot of conversations with Teo, who plays Hae-sung. He's incredible in the movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And he's just so ugly.
Hard to look at. Yeah.
It was honestly distracting just how ugly he is.
You made it through.
See, I'm a good actor. He has such a different, he's so German, and he's not here, so I can, you know, talk shit about him. This is genuine. He owns his melancholy in such a different way. Like, it's cultural. I, as someone who's like highly therapized, highly, you know, I'm American and yeah, like have had this experience. I have like, we collectively, we have walls. Like, we're not it feels counterintuitive sometimes to be completely vulnerable. It doesn't feel safe because of certain infrastructures in our society and things that have happened are the painful real history of a lot of the experience for, you know, whether you're just like for any outsider, like it just, you are, we are self-engineered to not show that, never show that. It's a matter of survival. So then to have to over months just show that, but like through her strength though, like was really eye-opening and really devastating. And also just like having to do a love story. I'd never done that before. And I was talking to another actor about like how it's like your body doesn't know it's not real. Having to take on not just one, but two deeply connected, deep loves that span multiple decades and lifetimes, like, oh my God, it really put me in a state where I could understand finally. Sounds so cheesy, but like, I mean it, like reconciling with this idea of as human people, we have such a innate capacity for love, both giving it and receiving it. It's boundless. It's endless. I really believe that now. You know, at the risk of sounding like Jared Leto at like a hippy dippy retreat, like I really feel like I've emerged from the world, you know, and I'm kind of looking around like, oh my God, how I see this in a different way now. And I'm so glad for it too.
And I have to say, I think that what you're speaking to, you, the viewer, feel that it transposes from your performance in a weird, to keep it on the theme of the neurological, like something happens when you watch this film. It's not like watching a regular movie. It took me a while. You know, you were speaking to sort of like how you came out of the film from a process perspective. I think it takes the viewer a little while to reacclimate to real life. I remember I went to the screening in New York, and like I walked out afterwards and there was like a cocktail reception and everyone's like, you know, chumming about. And I'm like, I'm not ready to be in around people right now and talk. I am in process mode. Feelings are lifting out of me. So I get it.
Good. I'm glad I can share that with you.
Keeping on the theme of food, because we're talking about the bagels here, in the film, your character Nora, in bed with her husband, says that she is craving chicken wings. And I'm wondering, what is Greta's most persistent food craving?
A hot dog. I know. Nitrates are like the number one thing that will kill you. I just have this thing. I think it's like all fast food, but it's a nostalgia thing. Like it's an immigrant kid thing. Look, I am, you know, a Hollywood starlet who can green juice like anyone else. But like the truth is, I have these days where I need to reset by eating something like a Big Mac with a side of chicken nuggets and sweet and sour sauce. Or like a hot dog, like movie theaters make really great hot dogs. And I know other hot dog enthusiasts, like we can like identify each other out in the world. Like you get it. There's just something about it. It's like the perfect meal.
Now, where do you get the perfect hot dog? Because I feel like it's really easy to tell someone like, this is where the great pizza is, or like, this is where a great burger is. I'm less familiar with like, do you have like the spots? You're like, oh yeah, this is where the good hot dog is.
Well, I don't have them anymore because I moved to LA. Yeah. It's like,
I feel like LA is like distinctly not about a hot dog.
Distinctly anti-hot dog, for sure. You know who used to, and like, gosh, fingers crossed that they still do this. Okay, do you know the Bearded Lady in Brooklyn?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They have such a good hot dog because they understand. They understand as an evolved adult who's functional, that person wanting a hot dog, like what that's going to be, mm-hmm. You know, and they're not shying away from the essence of what makes a really good hot dog to scratch that itch, but they're also able to elevate it while giving you what you need.
Right.
So they do a Chicago style dog with the whole thing, like mustard, tomatoes, onions. And one could say maybe it's sort of like there's a salad on the hot dog. So there you go. Like,
yeah, it's its own form of a green juice in some sense.
It is.
I loved the East Village-iness of this film, as I sort of mentioned earlier, especially having had not grown up, but, you know, a lot of formative years spent in the East Village. And there's this fantastic interview that director Celine Song did with Vulture, which I really encourage people to read. The interview itself is its own, like, form of art. It's just so fantastic. And in that interview, Celine talks about choosing the location, the block that would be Nora's apartment. Her instructions were, quote, "It has to feel like nobody has ever given a shit about it. But also, it has to feel dreamy, like the whole film." And I love that description because she succeeded in that. She and the location scouts and the team that worked on this film. What is your favorite block in New York City?
It's so hard because anyone who's lived in New York, like, you know that. Like, that is the essence of life there. Like, these blocks that are both, like, dumpster fire trash, but then also heaven, you know? I mean, so many different parts of New York have their own sense of history.
Yeah, let's qualify by saying one of your favorite blocks so that, like, we relieve some of the pressure.
For me, up by Lincoln Center still has this feeling. It brings me right back to being a kid and having this irrational desire to chase this hypothetical dream for some reason, to be a part of this thing. And it's like nameless and wordless, but I knew that there was a version of it that existed by Lincoln Center and the fountain. And, you know, and I still, when I go there, it makes me want to be alive. It makes me feel invigorated. I think I want to be buried there.
I love it. I love it. It might be a hard permit to get, but, like, you know, you can make things happen.
I'm not there yet. You know, I think some other things need to happen before I have the resources and ability to, I don't know.
I think you're on the trajectory to getting there, though. So, I mean, like, we're making big steps. You know, another interesting thing about this film is you have a large chunk of the film that you are not in, but your character is in. And I'm referring to young Nora. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how unique that is to you are the viewer, in some sense, of this film for a portion of it in which you're watching your character not played by you.
Right.
And I wanted to know what that sensation is like by getting to, like, occupy a character with another actor.
Yeah, well, I was so pissed I didn't get to Korea. When we wrapped in New York, they went on to do Korea. So, you know, I had to like watch them, literally watch them do that leg of the shoot. Yeah, the actress that they found for young Nora is incredible. Seung-ha Moon. She, and I remember Celine was sharing some audition tapes of various young actresses who were all incredible. I mean, like real pros, but there was something about her that was just this ineffable quality. It just, like, she has ambition, like capital A, and it burns through her. And it informs like everything she does and her physicality. She's like bottled up kinetic energy and like also like such a flirt, like such, like with grown-ups, like just such, she's such a star. I mean, process wise, she was enormously instrumental, the two of them, in setting up the chemistry that you see for adult Nora and His Hong. Like, we really are so indebted to them and what they were able to create, the two of them together, before you meet us at all. But yeah, watching her go through it, I don't know, it made it like even more emo because it felt like it's that feeling when you see yourself in pictures of your from your youth. You don't feel like that person. They feel like a stranger separate from yourself. And you have to do that, the like analysis, the calculus of, did that person get to me?
Yeah.
And that's that thing, I guess, we were talking about earlier, like constructing your narrative or processing. That's all that is. But I think that was so great in the movie because that's just accurate. Like, that's how we do it. Like, how did I become this from that?
And one thing I really love about the young Nora as it's written by Celine is that you get the complexities of Nora even from her younger self. You have this idea where she, when she's around Haesung, she doesn't really show too much interest in him. I'm thinking like about their final moment together when she doesn't even so much as say, does she say goodbye? Do we get a goodbye?
No. No. And that is such a true, like, you know, I have two young kids. That's how kids say bye. Bye not.
Right. And yet, when she's talking to her mom earlier in the film, she's very forthright about the fact that, like, I like this boy. I like him a lot. I want to date him. And so I like that you get these many shades of Nora, even in a glimpse of her younger self. So, yeah, terrific writing, terrific performance. Now, moving away from past lives, RuPaul says that life begins after 40. In Vogue earlier this year, you stated, quote, I want to not seem so young to people. I find it tiring. I gotta say, Greta, I feel that quote, and I bet a lot of people do. What are your thoughts around 40 and the decade of 40 as life beginning, life opening up?
This is like the unknown, truly. Growing up, you know, when you imagine different stages of your life, and I'm talking like when we're really young, for me, I don't think I thought past 27. It's so funny how, like, and maybe there's something biological to that, like why we're not geared up to really, in a hyper-specific way, imagine what our future would be like after a certain age. I don't know. I'm like trying with my therapist and other supportive people in my life. I want to accept this new idea of like, how can I live a life that is, you know, with dignity and this grace that comes from accepting, like, this is me. Like, I am this. And the thing about loving, like, now, like, people won't, like, I don't know, assume that I'm much younger. Like, I think that just comes from years of, well, I'm interested what it is for you. For me, it does have a lot to do with race. It does. Being a person of color. And I know you can like make a lot of jokes about like Asians and how, you know, we don't age and like, sure. But I think one of the, this experience that I have been having over and over again with work is like this feeling where I'm constantly having to reintroduce myself in a way. And with that, there are so many assumptions that are made of like, how old are you? Like people assume that I am much younger. Like sometimes like in my late 20s, like in a way that would feel like a compliment to most people. But like for me, I just feel like that feels so odd to have to kind of like gently announce and make clear to people like, oh no, I'm 40 years old. The painful truth of that, of like why that is, it's like, it's not pretty. Like, I don't think it's a good reflection of our world. Like why it would be that if I walk onto set, and sure, if it's 4 a.m. and it's dark outside and I'm wearing pajamas, but why would someone presume that I am half my age? And the expectation of what that is, of just kind of refusing to play that game anymore, feels nice about being 40.
You have every reason to be offended by that, and yet their intention is the polar opposite, and that just feels so complex to me in terms of how to rationalize that.
I was trying to explain this to someone, like, imagine getting invited to, like, a fancy dinner party, and that moment before you ring the doorbell and you step through and you're getting ready to kind of introduce yourself to this group and make yourself known to them. And there's like a level of like, yeah, putting my best foot forward, making myself palatable, taking up space, but not too much space. And really like surprising people with whether it's like your charm or your skill or, you know, who you are, this element of surprise. And then if you're lucky, having and experiencing this sensation of success of like, I've won them over. I think I'll get invited again. But then having to repeat that experience over and over and over again, like it's Groundhog's Day.
Wow.
I feel like that's what it feels like to be an actor who's a person of color. Or, and maybe that extends to other people and their experience, anyone who has just felt overtly like the messaging is you don't belong. Sure, there are moments maybe you will feel like you belong briefly, but that like unconscious knowledge that at any given point, like you're going to be asked to leave or like the dinner's over until the next time. And I think I'm only now understanding after years of that, of what that is and how that affects me as a person and how it affects my work, actually. Because I'm burdened by this experience of having to constantly, tell them, oh, guess what? I'm not 30 something, like I'm 40. Hi, I'm Greta Lee. How much energetically that it's draining. It's draining. And I wish I could reserve that for the actual thing, the stuff I want to put all my energy into. And I look over at some of my peers and I can admit that sometimes I feel enraged because I can see this is something that is singularly my experience in that moment. And I look over and, you know, my comrades are like eating chips and like preparing for the next scene. And like, I feel like I have this other thing that's going on.
Did you feel like working on this film and having the opportunity to work with so many Korean and Korean Americans in this film and thinking about working with Celine, for instance, and did that change the paradigm at all when you were working with other people of color? I imagine overwhelmingly people of color on this film.
Yeah, it became a non-issue. It really revealed through me. Mm. It was like a Trojan horse, like in reverse. And that did something to the process. But also having Celine only direct Teo and I in Korean and in English for John and I, but normalizing different languages, it just was so liberating. Like I didn't have to feed that machine of like, you know, taking care of political issues of like, or explaining like, okay, like this is representation or like I'm taking up. We were just making a movie about love. And it was really great.
How incredible, though, to get Celine giving you the direction in Korean like that. What a singular experience to have that's so, not singular, well, excuse me, singular in an instance like a film like this. I think that's just so incredible. And then you also have the opportunity where she then goes and you have scenes with where she's speaking English with an English-speaking co-star. I just feel like that's so incredible that you got to experience both of those things on a single film.
But you're right. It is singular. Like it, that doesn't happen.
But I hate calling that singular.
I hate it too, but it's true. And hopefully it won't be true forever. And I feel like a movie like this is evidence that maybe like we're ready for that not to be a singular experience. And it can still be an American movie.
Yeah. Okay. Couple last questions before I let you go, just because you are regarded by so many, myself among them, as a style icon. I have to say your recent shoot that you did, the Loewe Interview Magazine shoot, like, just like the way you wear clothes, it's just, you've got it. How would you describe your style?
I'm so bad at answering these questions. And I kind of like, I want to keep it that way.
Good.
Like it's somehow like essential to what I, like my relationship to clothes. Clothes, like it's a visceral experience for me. That's why I love Jonathan so much. Like there's something about his clothing that feels like emotive and it feels very like it's honing in on like existentialism. I mean, I feel like he has this quality to the clothes and how they feel that is like, is hard to pin down. And that's usually what I'm drawn to. It's not athleisure. It's like, the way it feels, it can be track pants or trousers, but something that feels like athletic and like I'm able to, you know, I have like full range of movement, but that feels also, you know, with something else that has movement in it. Like I love like coats and dusters and things like that.
I love a duster.
Love dusters. And I love color, which like is feels silly to have to announce that, but a lot of people don't love color. And I do, I love color. I'm like very activated by that.
I feel like there's something about being a fashion girl where there's a conditioning that's like, because you're a fashion girl, color out the window. So I like that you're a fashion girl who likes color.
Yeah, I'm pro color. Yes, I am.
Being pro color is good. I'm curious about what's on your media diet. I mean, like I said, you're incredibly busy. You're working constantly. You're a wife. You're a mother. You're a friend. You wear many hats. Do you have, I mean, I imagine you make some time to consume media. What is it you're watching?
Well, I have a gaping hole the size of Succession, I think, like most people. I don't know what to do about that.
I know.
I think after COVID, something happened to me where I wanted to like step back a little bit in terms of what I'm consuming and just be a little bit more mindful. Like it's sort of, I realized just how much I was consuming and feeling like, oh my gosh, like as a person, like, is this unnatural just to be consuming like this much? I guess I'm talking mostly about TV. And maybe this, I shouldn't be saying this because it's like my industry. Yeah. I had started to feel like numb to content. I've gone back to museums. I know I'm like 100-year-old lady, but I do a lot of more music, live music, and seeing and experiencing things that don't involve screens. I mean, I'm trying to do that. And I can see how much more I'm getting out of it. And this is mostly because Succession ended.
Listen, I get it. Now, on the museum train, I don't know Los Angeles, so I'm going to keep it New York.
Yeah.
What is a museum that you'd recommend people check out outside of the obvious list? I'll go first, just because I was just there recently. The Noguchi Museum in Queens is like just mandatory.
Oh, well, you took mine.
Sorry.
We can both have it.
Okay, fine. Yeah, we'll share it.
Yeah. And also, you know, sidebar, if you're like an Akari lamp head, then, you know, you can also, they have every lamp for you available there. And now I'm getting to know some of the art space more in LA. But I didn't really realize like what exactly is at my fingertips or what was there. Like I find this is not museums, but like I've never profoundly missed like Joe's Pub so much in my life. like just as a space, like I miss going to see random things so much.
I get it. You exited social media several years ago. I get the sense from what you said about your media consumption that there might be something wrapped up in that, which is this idea of like just less screen time in general. Is there ever a world in which you could find yourself dipping a toe back in there? I know that like for people that remember you from your time on social media, you were something of a legend of social media. So I'm just wondering if there's any inclination or small desire to come back.
I was. I mean,
yeah, you were. Yeah, you know, you were.
When I joined, it was like this dorky thing. Like it was like a cringy, very real thing. It was. I can imagine myself coming back to it. I thought about it for a minute with past lives stuff. Because I didn't want to look back on this time and like if people didn't show up for the movie, feel like there's something I could have done to help. But like, it's a thing. It's how I feel about being 40 and like the life that I'm like putting myself on assignment, like this personal mandate I have for myself of like this question, like, can I live my life in this way that feels like more difficult on some levels because I'm not cashing in on certain things that feel accessible or like would make certain roads faster. But I'm like, I'm betting on this other thing and it's hard to explain. I'm like so greedy for life and I don't want to waste it. And for me, everyone's different, but for me, Instagram, social media, that was me wasting it. And sure, like I will check it sometimes. Like I have a fake account, a Finsta that is like just like home decor, like chairs. Like, so, you know, this made end up being my fatal flaw in terms of my like career or whatever, but I don't care. It's worth it to me.
It will not be a fatal flaw, if I may say. And I've got to say, I am betting on you, Greta Lee. I am betting on you. This has been a delight. I adore you. I think that you, I can't not say it to you. I am looking forward to what I believe is going to be a lot of attention coming your way around this role with this film opening. I'll leave it at that, but all the good things that I know are coming your way, by way of recognition of quality work are so incredibly deserved. And I'm so happy for you.
Thanks so much, Evan. This has been so nice. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I will hopefully talk to you again sometime soon.
Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan.
And can I make a deep cut request? Is there any way I can get a Sujin? Shut up, Evan.
Shut up, Evan.
Shut Up, Evan is produced by me, Evan Ross Katz, with audio editing by Sophia Asmuth and social media by Griffin Dunn. Shout out to our Patreon subscribers for their financial support, and thank you to you all, the listeners, for helping us keep the lights on.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.